just wait here. Just wait here. I've got to stand on my little plinth. Come a bit closer. I think we're more, aren't we? Somebody missing.
Derek's missing.
Derek. Where's Derek? He's probably with the First Folios. Did you see him come, Ian? Ian? Come a bit closer. I did. So where is Derek? Did anybody see him?
He's probably in there.
Walking across.
Oh, he's having a cigarette. One of the two.
Okay. Tibby, could you duck out and see if you can find Eric? Oh, he's coming. Michael, did you see Derek? Okay. So if you could all come closer, because I can't shout. Closer. Was there somebody else there behind you? Just you. Okay, I want to say a few things. First of all, you've got your learning partners tonight. Now, I've asked Francis to run off the first two sides, so that's the first four pages of Act 5 of As You Like It from the text that I've given her. And it would be good with your learning partners if you could read through that. Next week we're starting with As You Like It in earnest, Act 5 in particular. I'm going to give you a lecture on the whole story and tell you how Act 5 fits into that, but we're going to use parts of Act 5 for our performance. I'm also going to try and put up, before your learning partners, if I get time, a couple of exercises that you might like to do along with reading the Shakespeare text. I'll be posting that up around about 5 o'clock. And next week I hope to have your assignments back, and I will be looking at your blogs this week. So that's to do with class. Now, with here, my aim here is to first of all show you some of the wonderful works in the gallery that not only connect with Shakespeare, because there are a few that connect with Shakespeare, but also some that connect with some of the poetry and the prose that we've been looking at so far. Now, there's two ways in which art connects to literature. One is through themes. Like, for instance, somebody can paint a beautiful gum tree, and that reminds us of Judith Wright's Wattle Tree. And what an artist can do, they can bring certain aspects of an image to life in a way that a poet can't, or they use a different medium. So there's themes. Now, Joey just mentioned to me that he'd heard a program yesterday about artists who were using symbolism in their paintings. And, of course, poets use symbolism as well. So art and literature have got a lot of things in common. But whereas a writer uses words and images and word sounds, an artist uses paint, texture, shape. So a lot of overlaps. So I'm just going to take you around some of my favorite works. And if you've got any questions, you can ask as we go. And some of the things we'll be looking at will be from the point of view of theme. Others we'll be looking at from the point of view of connection to things we've read or are going to read, like round there is the portrait of Henry Lawson, and I warn you, we've all got to kneel down for 23 minutes in front of that portrait.
Can I just do a reverence?
Can you just do that? You can do that. That's it. All right, let's go. First, Greg, over here. Come stand around here and look up this way. So this is a good place to start as any. But behind me are paintings by one of the first Australian colonial artists, John Glover. Now John Glover was a very poetic soul who actually started painting in the Lake District in England around the time of the Romantic poets Wordsworth and Coleridge. And that's they took it away. Sorry, it's gone. It was there last week. There was a landscape he painted in the Lake District, but it's not there anymore. He came to Tasmania in the 1830s, and he painted Australia as if it was like a new Eden, a place where human beings could discover a new soul for themselves. because of course England was in the middle of the Industrial Revolution. So Australia was like a wonderful place where, here you can see he's painted himself and his artist's wife sitting, gazing out over nature in awe of the majesty of this unpolluted land full of all God's grandeur. So that's the kind of feeling we get in a lot of early Australian paintings, is this glorified sense that Australia is full of newness, full of a new kind of life. And here is a painting of his home at the foot of a mountain near Hobart in Tasmania. And here he is again, he's painted himself with his dog, meditating on this landscape, soaking in all the beauty of this this wonderful, wonderful country. That's very early colonial Australian art. This is in the 1830s, 1840s. Now when we come down to the end of the gallery down here, Ian. Yes. So here, this is about 60 or 70 years later. This is after the colony has been established, and Australians are wanting to make a kind of a deeper spiritual connection with aspects of the landscape. And, well, what is this artist saying about the Sydney red gum? How does this painting bring the red gum to life? What kind of feelings or emotions are being expressed through this image, would you say? Any suggestions?
Really it's triumphant.
Central, majestic. Triumphant, majestic. Talk about creating a symbol out of a natural object. Here, the gum tree becomes symbolic. Well, Chris has already mentioned some of the features, some of the qualities that it expresses.
Endurance.
Endurance, yep. And there's something about the light as well. I think it's either early morning or late in the afternoon.
There's a beautiful job of the light, getting half shadow, half light.
Half shadow and half light. And you've got the kookaburra here. And just the sense of scale, the size, the majesty of the painting.
It does look as fresh, like there's a lot of fair trees up the back.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, I was thinking of a poem that was written 100 years after this by Judith Wright called A Wattle Tree, in which she kind of goes much deeper into the esoteric spiritual significance of a tree. This painting doesn't quite go in that direction. It's very interested in the natural look and feel of the tree itself. But it's nevertheless a kind of a homage to something that is distinctively Australian. Now, one thing that's really interesting is that when this artist painted this work, and when John Glover painted his work, these works were done in a studio. It wasn't yet fashionable, or hadn't even really been discovered, that you painted out of doors. And it was with Henry Lawson, who went walking around the landscape and found the language of the bush, brought those into his stories. It was around about that time that you also got the Heidelberg School of Artists, Tom Roberts and Streeton, who we're going to see in the next room, who painted all their work out of doors, and suddenly the landscape had this new life to it. But before we go in there, please come and do the genuflection that I have asked you to do in front of this figure over here. Henry Lawson, 1900. That's it.
That's it.
He reached the pinnacle of his career here. It was just before his first trip to England. He'd published a number of books, and he thought he'd reached the kind of stature of a great writer. From this point on, everything was downhill, as we saw last week. But The artist John Longstaff was one of the great portrait painters of the 1890s, 1900s in Australia. So these two rooms are the 19th century Australian art, and the next room is as well, actually, but it's a bit later. Sorry?
That's
Fred McCubbin, yeah. Okay, let's walk around and have a look at these artists who suddenly discovered how to paint outdoors. This way, Scott. Come a bit closer, folks. So, where's Joey?
Here.
Oh, Joey's there. So, in a painting like this one here by Arthur Streeton and Tom Roberts were a group, part of a group of artists who called themselves the Heidelberg School, because they started out in a suburb of Melbourne called Heidelberg. They went to France, they discovered how to paint out of doors, en plein air it was called. Then they came back and painted some amazing images of Australia. Now this, full of symbolism, which I'll show you in a minute, it's the building of the railway through the Blue Mountains at Lapston. And the particular event here is a rock fall in Lapston Tunnel, and it is a young man who's been killed by a rock fall being brought out on a stretcher here. There's a red flag up here indicating that there's an accident. But you can see from the harsh light, the blue sky, the bush, there's not the same attempt to paint things with the fine detail that you get in those studio paintings in the early 19th century. Here, Impressionism had kind of come to the fore. And Impressionism was painting, you know, quickly, but catching the light on the surface of things. And when you finish looking at this painting, if you look at the cabinet behind you, it's got in it paintings that were done on cigar box lids. And the cigar box lids in those days were 6 inches by 8 inches. It was called the 6x8 exhibition. It became very famous. They did these quick impressionistic paintings. But look at this here for a moment. Can you tell me what the difference is between this side of the landscape here and this side of the landscape here? Tone is different, yes, what else?
It's got more people, one's got more natural.
One's got more people, one's got more naturalistic. So here is the human invasion of the bush. And what do you see up here? What are some of the objects you can see in the bush here on the left?
Rock and trees.
Come closer, what else can you see?
It's the desolation of what man.
What else can you see on the left? Yes, John, you can, John? The desolation that man brings. What's up here on the left?
Well, gum trees. Well,
anything else you notice? Definitely gum trees. What else do you notice? Yeah, what else?
Rocks.
Yeah, what else?
Trees are broken.
What else?
Different colours are sort of white.
Actually, it's only from here that you can see what I'm trying to get you to look at, from here. There's, what did you say? No, somebody said something else. Somebody said something else.
Shadow.
That's shadow. What is this up here? Derek, let me jump on your shoulders. There! What's that? What is that? What is it? Can anybody see the red waratahs, the gymea lilies, the flowers? Can you see it?
Now you can see it.
And you can see it.
All red.
The red native flowers of New South Wales.
And there's a cross relationship with the red flag.
That's right. That's right. But actually, as you look at it, the whole forest is full of those red waratahs up there.
Coloured waratahs there.
You can't see it.
Yeah, now,
so the symbolism of man's invasion as opposed to allowing nature to have its course. Now look at this painting here by Tom Roberts. This is one of the most famous Tom Roberts paintings. It's called Bailed Up. Bailed up means you've been stopped, you've been robbed. Now, it's only in Australia that an artist could get away with making a robbery into a feature of a wonderful painting. It's very subversive, this is. It's, in a sense, it's saying that robbery, Ned Kelly, the attack on the establishment, the interference with all the hierarchies, is a good thing. That's one of the kind of implicit messages that comes through with Tom Roberts and these artists. And it's a bit like Shakespeare's Henry IV, you know, the attack on authority. So you get some of these artists identifying themselves with, you know, opposition to the world. So this whole room here is full of paintings of the late 19th century. And over here is a very interesting one. This one here, in 1905, this was at a time of great depression in Australia. A lot of people were out of work, a lot of people were on the streets, and this is called Poverty Makes Strange Bedfellows. So here you've got a park bench, these people, you know, out of work, nowhere to go, and, you know, this is an attempt to illustrate something of the kind of social hardships of people in Australia right at the beginning of the century. Back off the painting. Yeah, thank you.
It's cross-cultural with that original.
Cross-cultural, good observation. Very good observation. The strike's aftermath, it's put there because there's obviously a relationship. But while we're standing here too, this painting by Julian Ashton, The Prospector. Now we've looked at Henry Lawson, and we've looked at Henry Lawson's stories, which are trying to paint a picture of authentic Australia, whether it's that dry outback bush, or whether it's people out of work, or whether it's the drover's wife. Around the 1900s, at the time of Federation, both artists and writers were trying to find images or symbols that expressed what was the true Australia. And there was a tendency to glorify and ennoble these images. And here you've got the gold prospector, look, who looks like a Grecian god. And over your shoulder there, Ian, next to you, you've got shearers in the shearing shed who look as if they've just stepped out of the shower and have got deodorant under their armpits. They just look too grand. And, you know, there was this real attempt in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s to bring a real Australia into focus as a challenge to English mythology. Now, talking about English mythology, let us now step back 400 years to Shakespeare's time. Follow me. So this room and the room next door is paintings from the 1400s, 1500s and 1600s. And this one here is the first painting I want you to have a look at, Mars and the Vestal Virgin. Now this is based on an ancient Roman myth about how Mars, the god, came and raped the Vestal Virgin and produced the twins Romulus and Remus that were the founding of Rome. But this painting is, for me, like a scene out of As You Like It. As You Like It, with its interest in sensuality, with its interest in the beauty of the forest and the value of the forest and the colours, the whole painting here speaks to me out of a world from which Shakespeare was writing. So it's got all the kind of tone, the quality, and the human interest that you find, especially in As You Like It. And if you look across here to this gentleman dressed in this wonderful finery, Frans Bourbos, 1610, around about the time that Shakespeare was still active, this looks like one of the dukes, Duke Senior, in As You Like It, dressed in the very fine, ornate costume and all this wonderful tracery work around his neck. In this room also are landscapes, from the 15th and the 16th century. And As You Like It is a play very much about landscape. As You Like It is a play about the value of nature as opposed to the court. There's this sense in which those people who get thrown out of the court and live in nature have found a new kind of life. And that was certainly what some of these paintings, landscape paintings, are expressing. This one here in particular by Claude Lorraine, the landscape, the pastoral, is a world of stillness, of quiet, a place where you can gather your soul and not be corrupted by the world of the court. And then from this period, this wonderful still life over here. This has to be one of the most expressive paintings in the gallery. Still life was very popular in the late 16th, early 17th century. You've got a landscape through there in the background, but here you get a real sense of what, you know, people in Shakespeare's age, those who had a bit of money, would be eating. Look at all these oysters and prawns and grapes and hams, etc. So, you know, this is a real feast for the eyes as well as for the stomach.
No mangoes,
but you've got here, I think, looks like a melon, doesn't it?
Yeah, look at that ham.
Look at that ham.
Prosciutto.
Prosciutto, very much so. Yeah. Now, there's every work of art in here has such significance, but I want to show you in particular this plate out here. Where's Derek? Is Derek in there, Jack?
Yeah.
Joey, can you get Derek? Now this plate is a special interest to Derek. This is a special interest for you, but for everybody. Now, you've all heard about 9/11. You've all heard about how 9/11 put the East against the West and gave justification for George Bush to go out and attack Iraq, and where that's left the world at the moment. Now, in 1527, on the 5th of May, and that date is inscribed on the back of this plate, Rome was sacked by German and Spanish and French troops. And people felt in 1527, this is just before Shakespeare's time, that the old world had come to an end, that the authority of the church, the authority of Rome, had been extinguished by this attack on Rome. It was like the 9/11 of the 16th century. And this is called the allegory of the sack of Rome. And there's St. Peter, the rock upon which Jesus founded his church, standing very precariously on what looks like a football on the right-hand side, but it's probably the globe, looking down at this chaos that's produced by the sack of Rome. So paintings and art would also reflect historical events at the time and really give an insight to the kind of turbulence of religious belief and fears about stability. I wonder how they're going to represent our world with the Twin Towers having been extinguished and the incredible chaos that's been released in the Middle East in the last 20 years. How is this all going to come, you know, express itself in art? it is expressed in art already, but which of that art will survive, like this plate, which is, you know, 500 years old and doesn't even have a crack in it. It's amazing how works of art can somehow carry and contain the history of human nature at all levels, historical, emotional, personal, etc. And just swing your eyes around to the wall there and you'll see some characters that have stepped straight out of As You Like It. All the men in As You Like It are presented right there in front of you. That's how they dressed, that's how they looked, that's the sort of feelings they had, and that's what you're going to imitate in the next 4 weeks when you get up on the stage and represent these Shakespearean men and women. Some of you, unfortunately, are going to have to be women because we haven't got enough women in the group.
Oops, that's light. Germany was part of the Holy Roman Empire.
Well, some German troops.
Yeah, there were Vandals and Visigoths. Right. They weren't German troops.
Yeah.
That statement is false.
Yep, statement is
they're
false.
They're rewriting history for the current propaganda campaign.
That's interesting. So we're going to go now, we're going to go from, when you're finished, we're going to go from the 16th century to the 19th century. These are 1400, these. This one particularly over here is fantastic, the baby Jesus, amazing. So, when you're ready, folks, follow me around to the end here. I reckon that plate's probably worth the most.
Wow.
I reckon it is. It's absolutely priceless. So, art, like literature, was often used for all sorts of different purposes. This painting here on the wall by Joshua Reynolds, this is from the 18th century, 1700s, art in the 18th century was often produced to glorify the wealthy people. And here you've got this James Maitland, the Earl of Lauderdale. You know, he's paid a fortune for this painting and he gets this painting done and hangs it in his dining room to show how wonderful he is. So art has got many different sorts of uses. So this is the 18th century, but I wanted to take you into the 19th century room and show you a couple of my favorite paintings there. Come this way. So, just come a bit closer, Jack. So this is the Victorian room, the 19th century. And actually, this gallery was built around about the 1850s at the time of the Victorian age, about the time that the Queen Victoria building was built, etc. And this room was the first room that had paintings hanging in it. And the paintings that are in here, some of them have been here since the beginning of the gallery opened. In the 19th century, before the age of television and cinema, people used to like to come in here and sit down and discuss what stories the paintings told. Paintings were often very narrative and were telling stories visually. Now this painting here, this wonderful large painting in front of me, serves a number of purposes. First of all, it tells a great story, And anybody coming here would want to kind of ask, well, what are these people chatting about here? And what's going on in the background? It's a painting that kind of forces the audience to think and construct all the various stories that are coming out of it. But more importantly, I think you've got to stand to get that glaze off the painting. You've got a man standing in the middle reading from a book. And for literature students, you need to know who that man was reading from a book. It is the father of English poetry, Geoffrey Chaucer. Geoffrey Chaucer, reading from his book, The Canterbury Tales. Canterbury Tales is a wonderful book about ordinary people traveling on a pilgrimage to Canterbury in the 1300s. This painting was done in the 1860s, 1870s. So it's talking about 500 or 600 years earlier. And Chaucer is reading at the court of the King Edward III. And all these people down the front here are the official audiences for this reading. But as you can see, most of them are young people and are not really listening very closely to what Chaucer says. They've got their own conversations, they've got their own picnic baskets, they're carrying on down here. What's that old fuddy-duddy up there doing reading Chaucer? Sorry, Greg?
Did you do the seven deadly sins?
No, he didn't do the seven deadly sins, no. That was not Chaucer. Might have been influenced by it. The other thing that's worth noting is that this 19th century painting, if you come to university and do 19th century literature with me, one of the things we look at is those artists in the 19th century who were trying to escape the problems of the Industrial Revolution. And this group of artists, they actually called themselves the Pre-Raphaelite artists. Raphael was an early Renaissance Italian painter, and he used to paint wonderful scenes of life in a world that was much simpler and less confusing than in the industrial times of the 19th century. So this group of artists, the Pre-Raphaelites, they wanted to get back to that kind of simplicity. And this painting here is sort of pointing in that direction. Let's go back to the time of Chaucer, when there wasn't an Industrial Revolution. And the feature of Pre-Raphaelite art that was so distinctive was they loved bright colours. They loved to bring their scenes to life vividly. And, you know, the texture of the materials, everything. It's just a wonderful appreciation of the way that art can kind of bring life to life. But in the 19th century, there were different sort of impulses. Now, we haven't read any Charles Dickens, but if you come to university, we will be reading Charles Dickens's Hard Times, which is a book about the horrors of the Industrial Revolution, the way that working class people were kind of abused by the factory owners and all the struggle and the strife of what it was like in England in the 19th century. And there are some artists in here. This artist at the top here, Luke Fildes, who was actually an illustrator for Charles Dickens, the novelist. And in that painting, which is called The Widower, he's painting a picture of a widower who's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 children there, and one of the children is dying of cholera. The young babies in the front seem pretty unconcerned, but the teenage daughter at the back, she knows what's going on. Maybe mum's died about a month ago, and this widower is struggling to kind of know how to make ends meet and how to keep his job going and how to keep his family going at the same time. So, you know, artists here are stirring public conscience, they're trying to address the question of representing reality as it was, to make people take seriously the problem of England. So very different to this Chaucer at the court of Edward III. So you've got an artist here kind of escaping the modern world and trying to create a new world, and then somebody kind of confronting the world as it is. And if you turn around behind you, you've got the 19th century version of Hollywood. Here you've got the visit of the Queen of Sheba to King Solomon. And, you know, Hollywood, look at this frame. This is the original frame that was constructed for this painting. And, you know, before Hollywood, well, this man has created something here that, you know, would take days to unpack and think about. It certainly captures all the majesty and the pomp and the circumstance of a Hollywood movie. That would probably take about 10, 15 years to paint, unless he worked day and night for 12 hours on a ladder up there and so on.
No, he's an inventor, huh?
He didn't even try
trying to do it as a Hollywood movie with animation would take quite some time to create that set.
Well, that's like the, they didn't have cameras back then, so that's like the telegraph of the time.
Yeah, it is, that's right. That's right. Through his imagination.
But that one, this one, the documents, what?
That's a document. We're going through. That document is exactly, that's right.
Revolution, yeah.
Very.
I like that lady that's Charles Dickens freak. She does the documentary. She's a big lady.
Ah, yes, yes. Yeah, what's her name? Yeah, yeah. Very good.
Yeah, I like her. She knows so much.
She does, that's right.
Dickens fanatic. Yeah. But no one else knows Dickens like her.
Yeah.
She knows more than everyone put together.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
But it's Hollywood.
Just don't get me in the drama, please. I'm not acting.
You can be the stage manager. Okay, let's walk around to let's go to the early 20th century now. Still in England, early 20th century.
You have to come back another day.
You will.
You
will.
Oh my God.
Okay, so everybody come a bit closer around here, around this side. So this is the last room. Derek? No, I'm going to be talking about this here. So Jack, Derek, this is the last room we'll be looking at, because we need to finish about four to give you time to get back. We've now looked at colonial Australian, 19th century Australian, early 20th century Australian, Shakespeare, 18th century European, 19th century British. We're finally now in the modern age. And I want to start with this incredible sculpture here by the French artist Auguste Rodin. Talk about symbolism, talk about showing a shift in direction, and talk about the events that have happened in relation to Australia today. Now Rodin here, Rodin is one of the greatest French sculptors, and this sculpture here is a miniaturized version of the actual one that stands in London next to the Houses of Parliament on the Thames. If you go there, you can see them, they're larger than life size. But if you get to the Canberra Gallery, the National Gallery in Canberra, they've got a number of these figures there in the sculpture garden in Canberra. Now, what Rodin was interested in, he was interested in capturing raw human emotion. And you find that in a lot of contemporary art, like the art in the walls around you here, they were not interested so much in depicting, biblical scenes or social scenes or scenes from the past. They were trying to get to the raw emotions of things. Now, the story about this sculpture is that these five men were all about to be executed, and their execution is imminent. And Rodin wished to capture the expressions, the feelings, the state of mind of each one of these burghers of Calais about 3 minutes before they were executed. And I don't need to go into talking about execution at the moment in Australia. It's very much in front, all the forefront of our minds. But Rodin, as an artist, he was concerned to try and capture human beings at the extremity of their experience. And there's a story that goes with all of this, the burghers of Calais. Calais was a town that was being besieged for 6 months, and everybody in the town was dying. And finally, there was an ultimatum that the town would be opened and freed, and food would be allowed to come into the town as long as the six burghers, the leaders of the town, would come out, step out of the town walls, and allow themselves to be executed. That's the story. This is the event. And, you know, Rodin, if you look at the sculptures that we've just walked past in the 19th century, they're all very idealistic. They're all kind of beautifully shaped. But these sculptures, they are painfully in touch with the kind of inner emotions and torments of the characters that are depicted. And it's a kind of a wonderful gateway into what 20th century art was all about. 20th century art was turning away from the surface of reality and trying to get into what was going on in the soul of human beings. And that's what happens in a lot of 20th century literature as well, is this engagement with the inner struggle, the pain, the suffering, the spiritual realization, or the lack of spiritual realization, the torment. And 20th century art seems to be dedicated to that, and it's ironic that the 20th century became the space in which the First World War, the Second World War, the dropping of the atom bomb, all these most extreme events happened. Have we escaped that, or are we still in the throes of that kind of historical current? Good question. Got no answers.
Time will tell.
Time will tell. Joey, you're on the ball. So as you can see, we've just really scratched the surface of art. And if you come to ACU, I take every one of my literature classes to the art gallery once during the semester and look at the paintings that are specific to their particular course. And I love doing it, and students enjoy that way of seeing that literary themes, literary techniques are also played out in the world of art. Over here, incidentally, is the one Vincent van Gogh we have in the gallery. Of course, Vincent van Gogh is one of the great early modernist artists. Here is a self-portrait, head of a peasant. Head of a Peasant by Vincent van Gogh. And again, he's not interested in, you know, painting the kind of shape of the clothes and the frills of the hat. He's trying to get into the inner life, the inner experience, the pain, the suffering, the reality of that peasant's life. And many of Vincent van Gogh's paintings had that quality.
So we also get that soul. Based on
Vincent van Gogh?
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Well, I have recorded everything I've said, and I'll be putting that up onto Leo if you want to listen again. I'm going to go around now and take a picture of some of the pictures that we've done. So there'll be a blog topic on your visit to the gallery today, and you're welcome to use any of the pictures that I've put up there. And listen to this and you know, construct some response to that would be good. So thank you all. Thank you. You have to find your way out now. That's the tricky one. Down there.
There was
not a, sorry.
What was that song? I forgot. Dime, not.